Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 65 of Dogcast Radio. In this show, we focus on rescue dogs. We have a thought-provoking short story from Chandra Miller.
I've heard my friends wax rhapsodic about looking into their dog's eyes and communing silently. But this animal is so foreign, the hair stands up on my neck when our eyes meet.
And we learn about the power of rescue dogs to change and save lives.
As Buddy waited patiently by his kennel door, his tail pounding and his eyes fixed on his handler, the boy was amazed that anything could be so excited to see him.
We also have the Dogcast Radio news. But before all that, we talk to an author with some great advice on settling in a rescue dog. Susan Daffron wrote Happy Hand, a book to help owners develop a good relationship with their adopted dog or puppy. We jumped in with a big question. Why should people adopt a dog from a shelter?
Well, the most obvious and best reason to adopt a dog from an animal shelter is to save a life. Because as most people know, millions of dogs, at least in the U.S., are euthanized every year, and they're not bad dogs. They're just dogs that were unlucky in some way and ended up at an animal shelter. Another good reason is that people who have returned dogs, who have dropped off dogs at shelters, generally return them or drop them off because they say they didn't have time. So these people didn't anticipate how much work it is to have a dog and the responsibility of owning a pet. So the dog is taken to a shelter and his whole world is turned upside down. So you can, you know, you're reducing suffering by taking him out of that situation and giving him a wonderful life. Third reason is that it's good for the community, which is because, you know, your tax dollars at work, it costs money to impound dogs and investigate animal cruelty and abuse dogs and maintain an animal shelter. So by taking a dog out of the shelter, you're doing a good deed for your community. And the fourth reason is that you are doing your little part to reduce the pet overpopulation problem because shelter dogs invariably are fixed. They're spayed or neutered often before they go home, or you sign a contract to say that you will spay or neuter the dog, so you're not perpetuating the pet overpopulation problem when you, you know, when you adopt a dog from a shelter.
Now, obviously, you need to do some preparation before you adopt the dog from the shelter. So, now, one aspect of that is sort of what supplies are you going to need when you adopt a dog?
Well, the first thing you need is food, so have dog food. And you can talk to a veterinarian or, you know, other pet owners that you know for recommendations on foods. If you adopt a dog with health issues or a puppy, you may want to get special foods that, you know, for their age or health issues. You'll want bowls to put the food in. I tend to like stainless steel bowls because they don't scratch easily, so and they last forever.
Yeah.
The other thing, particularly if you're adopting a puppy, is you want to try crate training for house training, you may want to get a crate, which is like a sky kennel, which can help with house training. If you don't want to do crate training, you still might want to get a dog bed. Another thing you'll need is a leash. There are leash laws, and you should keep your neighbors happy by having your dog on a leash. And you will also, probably the most important thing, is to have a collar and ID. Identification is the most important thing you can put on your dog. People don't put ID on their dogs for the weirdest reasons, but having an ID will keep him from going back to the shelter.
Yeah.
Which is what you don't want.
Yeah.
And of course, toys and fun things too.
But yeah.
Particularly if you have a puppy, you'll want chew toys because he will chew.
Oh, yes. And you want to direct that chewing in the right place.
Yes, direct the chewing to the correct artifact.
Yes, yeah. You mentioned about the ID there. I can't tell you how you probably know how frustrating it is when you see a dog loose and you stop. Yeah. And you manage to get hold of the dog and you sort of give them a treat or whatever, call them over, and they're okay, and you check the collar and there's no ID at all. There's not even a cell phone that you can phone and just say, "Hi, I've got your dog." And it's so frustrating.
I know, I've had that happen. The worst of that is not even having a collar, because even if you're too, whatever, cheap, lazy, whatever, to put an ID on, you can take if you have a plain buckle collar that's made of nylon or something, you can take a big fat magic marker and write your phone number just on the collar, yeah. And that's still better than nothing. And that was, it's amazing how it takes so little to get your dog back home.
Yeah.
And people just won't put a collar on or an ID ID on the dog. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. Now, it's probable, isn't it, that if you do rescue a shelter dog, that you're going to have to do some training. So what are some of the misconceptions about training?
Well, one of the biggest misconceptions, I think, is that people think that it's an instantaneous, that's not a real word, but an instantaneous process, some kind of little magic pill that you can give your dog and suddenly he's Rin Tin Tin or Lassie and he's a fabulous, perfect model citizen. And the reality is that isn't true. And another misconception is that every one training method will work for every single type of dog. For example, I have four dogs and the way I've trained them is very different depending on the dog, because, for example, if your dog isn't motivated by food, the whole concept of clicker training or treat-motivated training that uses food as the motivator is going to be really difficult. Mm. It's a hard sell if your dog won't eat the food and doesn't care. And I had one dog, I did a clicker class, and she was like the dropout because she just couldn't possibly care less. No treat was interesting enough for her.
Mm.
So, and for example, some police trainers will use toys for dogs that are really motivated by play, like some Labrador Retrievers. It was amazing to witness this man training a drug-sniffing dog, and all it was a little rag, and that was the reward for the dog, and the dog would do anything to get to play with the little rag.
Yeah.
So one big thing is to figure out what motivates your dog. And then another misconception is the old tired saw that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, which isn't true. I mean, if a dog is older, he can still learn. And I sort of think that one's a little bit insulting. Like, you know, now that perhaps I'm past 40, did I suddenly stop learning things? Another misconception is, if I say it louder, he'll hear me. And, I mean, dogs have great hearing, so that's not ever going to be an issue. So it serves no purpose to yell and scream at a dog. You want to, he probably just doesn't understand you, so you want to show him what you want and avoid punishing, because you don't want your dog to ever fear you.
Mm.
And another sort of related item is people tend to anthropomorphize their dogs and say things like, "Oh, I already told the dog, he knows what I want." And realistically, dogs aren't psychic or people.
No.
So what they're looking for is responses. They don't, quote, know what you are thinking. If they do something and it elicits a response, even if it's not the response you want, many times the dog decides, well, I got some reaction, which is better than no reaction, so they continue to do it. This is actually frequently a problem where people are inadvertently training their dogs to do things they actually don't want them to do.
Yeah,
if you yell at the barking dog, he's now gotten your attention, which, to an attention-starved dog, it's like, oh, boy, I got her attention.
Mm.
And another misconception is, this sort of relates to really heavy-duty, sort of fear-oriented training and misinterpretation of the role of alpha in the pack, but the idea that you need to show the dog who's boss by being really domineering and actually mean. And dogs don't respond to that. They respect leadership, but they fear erratic, weird, mean people.
Yeah.
So you want to establish your leadership by having the dog do things to earn a reward rather than really heavy-duty punishment and that kind of thing.
And most dogs, you know, as you say, if you just find that the particular thing, whatever it is that motivates them, that they want, whether it's attention, toy, food, they are so willing and eager to please you. If they can just find out what it is, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you can see it sometimes, can't you, them thinking, well, what is it? Because I want to do it. I want the treat, you know, I want the toy, whatever, you know, but I don't quite know.
Or I want, I have one dog that was... So she was so overstimulated by even the smallest amount of petting that I had to really, when I was training her, she basically has the clinical equivalent of attention deficit disorder in children, so she couldn't focus. And so, you know, the traditional praising her effusively just sort of made her insane. So this was bad, because a dog that's, you know, jumping up and down and nutso is not focusing.
No.
And you can't teach a dog that isn't focused. So I had to really, I would praise her only by giving her a little scratch on her chest. And that was just so thrilling.
Uh-huh.
But that was all she needed. And I mean, now, years later, I can pet her and she has focus, and she basically evolved into a normal dog, more or less. She's still kind of a spaz, but you know, I really had to scale back the type of reward that I would give other dogs, you know, and even my own other dogs, just with her, because she is a different individual.
So
individual.
They are, aren't they? Yeah. Now, I guess another problem could be, you know, when dogs have ended up in rescue and you're not sure of what experiences they've been through and what's happened to them, and it must be so confusing for them, you know, they can become shy. So what can people do to help shy dogs?
Well, some of that is actually their personality. One of my dogs, who I got her at 9 weeks old from the shelter, she's never had, I mean, a cross word spoken to her, but she's just, by her nature, she's kind of an introvert, and she's a worrier, and she's not an extrovert. And her first response, instead of being adventurous, is to be fearful. And so to deal with her, you want to try and increase her confidence. And the way you do that is through a process called desensitization, which means basically give the dog the opportunity to be successful at remaining calm in situations that she finds stressful. So, you know, if I bring home a new vacuum cleaner or something and my dog Cammy looks at it and goes, oh my gosh, what is that giant thing in the living room? you know, first you do the incremental process. First you let her, on her own time, go up and sniff the vacuum cleaner, discover that it's not suddenly going to eat her, it's not the evil bad vacuum cleaner. And then over time, you know, turn it on for a second, see what her response is. The goal is to try not to overload her so that she has a big problem with it, but to introduce the dog to a new thing slowly, and it takes a lot of patience, really. So that eventually the dog will, I mean, now, you know, your dog will eventually decide that we're going to clean the house and the vacuum cleaner is going to come out and it's no big deal. And it just sort of takes a lot of time and patience to work through that. And then this also establishes trust between you and the dog, so that the dog knows that you're not going to be bringing in horrible, nasty, evil things into the house. But it is a slow process. But it's an important thing, because fear can sometimes lead to biting. In the worst case scenario, it can, you know, in addition to the dog being unhappy and you being unhappy because you have this weird dog that's hiding all the time, a dog who feels cornered and trapped can end up biting, kind of lashing out as a last resort, and that's what you really, really don't want.
Yeah, definitely. Now, on that subject, you know, when do you decide that this is, you know, a behaviour that you can't cope with, whatever that particular behaviour is? You know, when should you call a behaviourist for assistance?
Anytime you can't handle a problem. I mean, and people will have different levels of what they can handle and what they can't. But it's particularly important when safety is involved, because you probably know all about the dog bite statistics, but I mean, millions of people are bitten by dogs every year, and cases of dog aggression are extremely dangerous, and aggression could be either inter-dog aggression, where you have dogs attacking each other in the same household, or, you know, out on walks, or also aggression towards humans. I mean, realistically, a healthy, well-adjusted, happy dog doesn't bite, doesn't growl, doesn't do that kind of thing. But, you know, particularly with a shelter dog, you don't know its background, you don't know its health history. And some problems are actually, you know, just like there are axe murderers and bad, evil people that you probably don't want running around the streets. You don't want vicious dogs running around the streets
absolutely,
either.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, these dogs should never be bred, sold, given away, or adopted out of shelters. So hopefully you would never end up with a dog that had a serious, you know, essentially a brain chemistry problem. But I don't buy into the old saying that there are no bad dogs, only bad owners, because sometimes it is a physical problem. And as soon as you start having a problem, first you should contact a vet and find out. There are low thyroid can actually cause very strange behavior issues in dogs, for example. And other physical ailments can cause personality changes. But if the dog has a clean bill of health, if it starts behaving in a way that's unsafe, then you definitely would want to call in a behaviorist.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've mentioned this a little bit, but sort of what problems have you solved with your own dogs?
Oh, I have a whole laundry list of problems. I've had one dog with separation anxiety who basically tried to eat her way out of the house. I've had, well, the dog who was the one with attention deficit, essentially, she had problems with excitement urination. My husband actually could not touch her for the first 6 months we owned her, I think.
Yeah.
And that she would piddle on the floor anytime she got a little overexcited, which was almost all the time.
Yeah.
And she also jumped on people. The shy dog had problems with submissive urination, which is basically it's actually a deference thing. And so she was so shy that she would become so stressed out about us putting on the leash to take her outside, she would piddle on the floor. So that was a whole nother. So I've had the shy dog, the spaz dog, the dog who can't be alone, and I have another dog with allergies, and we've resolved digging problems, barking problems. It goes on and on.
Yeah. So I guess the message is, you know, there may be problems, but stick with it and get help if you need it, and you'll get there in the end.
Well, yes, and I think it's unrealistic to expect. I mean, just like people, everyone has problems, and every dog, I don't care if you get the most beautiful purebred dog in the world, which actually you can get a purebred dog in a shelter too, but it's not just shelter dogs, it's every dog's, because they're individuals, and they're going to have issues, you're going to have vet bills, there are responsibilities and expenses associated with owning dogs, but of course, as we'll all say, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Because you get a lot in return.
You do. I always think, you are the center of their world, and in return,
that's
they ask to be
sure.
just a little piece of yours.
I know. I always say that when you have a dog, you have your own personal fan club.
Yes.
Oh. Anytime you're feeling low, you can just know that somebody thinks you're really great.
If you're thinking of adopting your own personal fan club in the form of a rescue dog, and you'd like to read more of Susan's advice, then follow the links on the Dogcast Radio site. He cannot be a gentleman that loveth not a dog. Old English proverb. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. Dog-related research has been in the news recently, but if you read it all, you could be forgiven for ending up confused. First, there was the terrific news that having a dog in the house with children means they're less likely to grow up with allergies. This research came from Germany and showed that having a dog living in the same house as young children helps the youngsters to develop less sensitive immune systems, which in turn means that they're less likely to suffer from asthma, eczema, or hay fever. Interestingly, children who mixed with a dog regularly but did not have one living in the same house did not gain the same benefits.
So, living with a dog is good for our health then? Well, not if you read the comments made by Fred Landegg, who is just about to relinquish his position as Chief Veterinary Officer to the British government. Mr. Landegg was clear in his warnings that in his opinion it is downright dangerous to have a dog sleeping on your bed, or even in your bedroom. He also expressed fears about them being in the household kitchen, saying that they often carry food poisoning bugs, as well as MRSA. And he even mentioned the potential of zoonotic diseases, those that can be transmitted to humans. His comments came after a small-scale study in the UK revealed a fifth of dog owners questioned allowed their dogs to sleep in their bedroom. However, he did acknowledge that dog ownership brings many health benefits, so as long as you follow sensible hygiene rules, it isn't all doom and gloom.
Which is just as well, since an American study recently highlighted just how much we value our canine family members. The study, carried out by Larry Kurdeck, a psychology professor at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, questioned college students about their bond with their dog and with other human relatives. Many responded that they were as close to their dog as they were to their mother, their best friend, sibling, or partner, and closer to their dog than to their father. The study was published in the April issue of the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships, and Kurdeck is looking to extend the research. If you would like to take part in his new online survey, you can email him at larry.kurdeck@wright.edu or just click on the link on the Dogcast Radio site.
So, we've established just how important our dogs are to us. Well, imagine how you'd feel if you'd left your dog at a boarding kennel only to be given the wrong dog when you went to pick him up. Exactly that happened to a family in Oregon, USA. The black Labrador they took home with them just didn't behave right, so they returned her to the kennels. The owner of the kennel discovered that another black Labrador could have got mixed up with their dog, but the dogs were so similar that the family again took the wrong dog home, and the mistake was only revealed by a veterinary examination. Thankfully, both dogs have now finally been reunited with their rightful owners. Or at least we think so.
Meanwhile, in Moscow, a statue of a very memorable dog was unveiled. Laika, the first living creature in space, has had a monument erected to her memory. Before her spaceflight on Sputnik 2, the mixed breed dog was a stray. Her space journey in 1957 was always going to be a one-way trip, but it paved the way for human spaceflights.
Well, thankfully these days we have kinder ways of dealing with dogs in need of a home. And that's all from the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
I think dogs are the most amazing creatures. They give unconditional love. For me, they are the role model for being alive. Gilda Radner. Now it's time for some fiction that highlights the fact that sometimes taking on a rescue dog doesn't go according to plan. Here's a beautiful and thought-provoking story.
The Sweet Spot, written and read by Chandra Miller. For Hannah. My new dog stands in the middle of the living room, panting a little. Saliva drips from her black dotted tongue onto the hardwood floor, pooling there. She looks around the room. I am watching her, as I have the entire hour I've had her. Watching her, like she's as likely to spontaneously combust as she is to stand there and salivate. I've shown her the backyard, her bed, her water dish. The shelter people said not to feed her right away because she might be too nervous. Eating might upset her stomach. She doesn't seem nervous. Finishing her survey of the room, she blinks her yellow eyes at me, staring spookily. I've heard my friends wax rhapsodic about looking into their dog's eyes and communing silently, but this animal is so foreign, the hair stands up on my neck when our eyes meet. Foreign and hairy. She breaks off staring to sit down and scratch herself behind her ear with her back leg, and her sallow fur sails into the air like dirty snow. Why did I think this would be a good idea? I'm a grown-up, a single woman. I have a house, a yard with a fence, and today a dog. Kathleen, April, and Lola all agreed I needed something to love. Maybe they were just tired of playing the supportive friend role, but they all said a dog would be just the thing to help me get over Joseph, who just wasted 3 years of my life before telling me how grateful he was that I taught him how to love, so he could have this passionate affair with the woman he met online. April's two dogs are always happy for a pat when I visit, and Lola's puppy loves an innocent game of tug. Their dogs go with them everywhere, like innocuous furry sidekicks. I guess I thought it would be like that, or like the pup and toddler frolics you see on commercials, all sunshine and green grass. Instead, there's this smelly, shedding, pony-sized entity that shadows me with creepy persistence. The name she came with was Opal, I guess for her off-white coat. In the house, she turns into a dirty blonde. Part sled dog, the rescue people told me. I thought of the heroic dogs in that Eight Below movie that made Kathleen weep into her hands. I thought of the Iditarod, the Snowy Tundra, the Jack London books I read as a kid. Lola, whose puppy is a mere dachshund, tried to tell me 8-month-old 60-pound Opal was too big and her coat would take too much brushing. She talked up something called an undercoat. And since I was a first-timer, wouldn't I like an older, more settled dog? I tuned her out when she began describing the damage adolescence does to the dog-owner relationship. I was too busy picturing lanky Opal stretched across the foot of my bed, keeping my feet warm on cold winter nights. Never mind that we're in the middle of one of the hottest summers on record. Now here we are, in my formerly fur-free house, each waiting to see what the other will do next. I dial the air conditioning back to a chilly temperature on the theory that she'll be more comfortable, perhaps stop panting. I offer her water again, but she only sniffs at the surface of the liquid. She whines a little. I take her outside. "Go pee, Opal," I instruct her. She sniffs the grass avidly, but doesn't pee. She trots out to the middle of the yard and turns to face me. She bounces into a funny crouch with her front legs splayed. Her tail is flailing wildly and her mouth is open, showing all her big teeth. She starts running around the yard at top speed, breaking off flower heads and tearing up the turf. I can see that my landscaping is going to be a little different with Opal around. Right before my eyes, she bends her head to the grass and starts scrabbling at it with her front feet, digging for no apparent reason. I belt out my first, "No!" Her head pops up, making her big ears flop comically. She stares at me some more. Now what? Big dogs need lots of exercise, right? That's good, because I need to get out more myself. I get her leash and call her. She spins around and gets cranked up again, racing through the petunias I planted, the new herb patch, the parched lamb's ear. She even runs over to the maple tree and puts her paws up on the trunk and looks up like she wants to climb it. I've never seen a dog do that before. Not that I have much experience in the canine arena. I grew up in a house where the only non-human entity was a goldfish, one at the county fair, and it died within a week. Even our plants were fake. My mother was big on tidiness, on wash and wear, on permanent press. Houseplants, with their saucers of muddy water, their penchant for dropping leaves, were not high on her list, nor were animals. Low maintenance was the biggest compliment she could give to a person or item. I'm glad she can't see my yard right now. I catch Opal with the help of Pepperoni, a treat my friends claim is beloved by every dog on the planet. I jerk my hand back as she grabs for it, her enormous teeth nearly snagging my fingertips. Shaking out my hand, I watch her go to town on that Pepperoni. It's gone in a nanosecond. I drop the next one safely on the grass and manage to snap the lead on while she's scarfing it up. Off we go for our first walk. But Opal doesn't seem to get the walk idea. She races me to the back gate, and once outside the yard, she barges ahead, nearly taking my arm out of its socket. I'm forced to jog along on tippy-toes behind her till I can pull back with both hands on the leash. I decide to keep her close to me for better leverage, but she swerves right in front of my legs and knocks me to my knees. End of walk. As she's jumping about my suddenly accessible face, the neighbor kids go by on their bikes, snickering and pointing. I get to my feet and haul her around toward the back gate again, both of us listing to the right as we execute a wobbly about-face. We've gotten as far as the end of the driveway. In the days that follow, I continually realize what my friend's dogs have concealed so cleverly, that they are like babies with bottomless needs and definite desires. Actually, dogs are worse than infants. They do way more damage than a baby ever could. If I leave her outside unattended, Opal goes to work excavating my yard, which is now pockmarked with her prodigious droppings. Try as I might to diligently clean up, it seems there's always a pile I miss, and it's guaranteed to be right where my foot comes down the next time I walk through the yard. Inside is no better. One half of my couch now has its innards on the outside. The baseboards I so lovingly painted that first week in my new home are in shreds. Another victim of her hyperactive choppers. I try tethering her in the kitchen while I'm away, but she eats the nylon leash and pushes through the swinging door to the living room, where she continues her work, starting on a corner of the carpet, since the couch has been dispatched. I try barricading the swinging door, but a mere china cabinet is no match for Opal's exuberant sorties. April advises a crate. They're den animals. They don't mind, she assures me. But I hate the idea of putting Opal back into a cage. Isn't that why I adopted her, so she wouldn't have to live in a cage anymore? Kathleen says to double Opal's exercise. A tired dog is a good dog, is her soothing mantra. Lola doesn't weigh in, for which I am grateful, because she has every right to say, I told you so. I now rise early, even on weekends, to take care of Opal's exercise needs. I no longer need an alarm clock. She's right there at 5 a.m., poking me with her snout, and lowing like a cow with a sore throat, and if I ignore her, the moans turn to full-throttle wails, punctuated with surprisingly high yips. Meanwhile, she body-slams the bed for emphasis. Before I had my own, I thought dogs only woofed, whined, and growled. Lassie seemed to get the point across with that slim repertoire. But now I know the full range of vocalizations and how ear-splitting they are at close range, even when one's head is under the covers. Once out of bed, I take my coffee outside, sit on a lawn chair, and play with Opal. I throw a ball. She runs after it, grabs it up in her mouth, and comes back, swinging her head from side to side. Will she give it back to me? No way. She wants me to chase her. It's 5:30 in the morning. I'm not chasing anybody. I'm scared to grab it out of her jaws. Put it down, I implore her repeatedly. Put it down or I'm going in, I say, pushing out of my chair and turning toward the door. She drops it. This is my first experience of dog intelligence. I feel like Anne Sullivan must have, watching Helen Keller spell out water. Every time Opal comes back with the ball in her mouth, I repeat my phrase and pretend to reach for the door. Works like a charm. Our mutual excitement fades as Opal tires of the game after just a few flings of the tennis ball. She fixes me with her wolfish yellow eyes again. I slump in my lawn chair and tell her to go play. I have a Martha Stewart Living magazine I could read. But she is not satisfied. She keeps drilling her nose into my elbow, jostling my coffee mug dangerously. I pat her. She spins away. What does she want from me? In the evenings, I come straight home to see what damage she's done that day. I can tell she's glad to see me because she jumps up on my dry-clean-only suits and deposits her fur and slobber on them happily. I try to fend her off till I can change into my new dog uniform, gray shorts and a t-shirt, a shade darker than her coat. Then I can pat her and ruffle her neck fur, an endearment that makes April's dogs lean into my hand. Opal, however, scoots away. "You're so contrary," I tell her, trying not to care. On a whim one evening, I drive her to the park and sneak her into the ball field, which is about 6 times the size of my backyard. I watch her sprint along the fence, so fast she's just a blur. Warmth blossoms in my chest at the sight of her, so free and joyous. When it's time to go, I realize I've forgotten the pepperoni. She doesn't come when I call her, and I can't catch her to get her back in the car. She spends what seems like hours wheeling and dodging on the packed dirt, sending dust devils floating above her. She taunts me with her superior acrobatic moves. A month ago, I would have said an animal was not capable of teasing a human, but now I know differently. Her lolling tongue, grinning mouth, the saucy tilt of her head all say, "Na, na, 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 na." I get so fed up, I just sit down and cry in the middle of the field. It's nearly dark when I look up to see her a few feet away from me, rolling in what's left of the grass. She's so absorbed in twisting her body and grunting ecstatically that she doesn't care when I grab her collar and snap on her lead. I resist the temptation to jerk her to her feet, instead standing there waiting while she finishes up her bizarre doggy breakdancing. From a distance, I probably resemble an indulgent dog owner like my friends, smiling down at my silly, oversized pup. If any of the kids playing on the park playground should stop to watch us here in the middle of the ball field, I doubt they can see the clench in my jaw or hear my muttered curses. Later that night, my friend Kathleen stops in. She is a dog lover who, by circumstance, only has cats at the moment. She sees my waggling, shedding Opal as her own personal love object, and she immediately sinks to the kitchen floor to enfold the stinky dog in her arms. "She smells like sweaty dog," I warn Kathleen, despite being informed repeatedly by my helpful Greek chorus of friends that dogs do not sweat, except from their paw pads. Kathleen ignores me. Opal sprawls halfway across her lap, still panting. Kathleen lowers her head to the top of Opal's, crooning to her, "Why didn't your mommy tell me you were such a snuggle butt?" When she gets around to addressing me, it's all about the dog, of course. She asks me a baffling question. "Where's her sweet spot?" I think of the way Opal turns away from me when I pat her head, as if something or someone more exciting might appear in the middle distance. When I have no answer, Kathleen seems to go in search of a sweet spot with her fingers, digging her stubby nails into the fur along Opal's spine till my dog's face turns goofy, her rubbery lips stretched wide, eyes dreamy, one back foot tapping the floor. After Kathleen leaves, I turn the TV on, and Opal curls up on the as-yet undestroyed portion of the oriental rug. I can hear her sigh over the din of sitcom inanities. I mute the laugh track and watch her instead of the show. She looks so benign with her head resting on her paws. Her yellow eyes are slits. Her rib cage moves with her breathing. I slide off the couch to the floor. "Opal?" She twitches her ears ever so slightly, then raises her eyes to mine without moving her head from the floor. The lift of her brow gives my heart a twinge. "Opal, come here, would you?" I pat my thigh. Kathleen made it look so easy. Maybe it is.
That was The Sweet Spot, written and read by Chandra Miller. And here's a poem by the same author, inspired by her dog, Hannah.
"My dog, she's no spring chicken. But she likes to say she is, once in a while, rising above her deaf and stiffening, tired old self, running to fling herself down, rolling in the grass and clacking her teeth at the elusive furred tail tip, a single yap betraying a twinge in the joints, or an inkling of puppyhood, or just joy for the moment, always the moment. Before long she dozes, but in dreams she can pretend to youth, feet pads singing a squirrel's death knell. All four paws and sometimes even whiskers get into the chase, a doozy of a run, full throttle for that sassy red-tailed threat to humankind. Wake her with a pat, and the old dog startles, looks out through muddy eyes, surfacing from some place deep, a place of puppy breath and white sharp teeth and uncalloused toes and springs in the knees, where lumbering squirrels, too fat to climb a tree, submit to the supremacy of my dog, No Spring Chicken, except in her dreams, except in the sweet songs of four sleeping feet.
If you'd like to find out more about Chandra's writing, you can visit her blog livingmindfully.blogspot.com, which we have a link to. A big thank you to Chandra for her contribution to the show. You can hear an interview with Chandra in episode 55 of Dogcast Radio, and more of her fiction in episode 47. Definition of sick building syndrome. No dogs allowed. Susan Conant, dog mystery writer. Caring for Your Rescue Dog by Louisa Adams was recently published by Angela Patchell Books. It contains the real-life stories of 60 rescue dogs, and I spoke to Angela about the inspiration behind the book.
I was inspired actually to publish this book by my own rescue dog called Cleo, who's a gorgeous Irish setter who I rescued from an animal sanctuary in County Wicklow, Ireland, over 10 years ago. She had been severely neglected and totally misunderstood, and when we first got her, she had no hair on her tail and was a nervous wreck with everybody.
Aww.
And when we took her to the local vet in Wicklow Town, which was about 2 miles away, he said to us, I know this dog. She was brought in here to be euthanized, and she licked his face.
Aww.
And he told the home there was absolutely nothing wrong with the dog and to take her back and give her one last chance.
Mm.
She'd had about 3 or 4 different owners had all sent her back to the home after she displayed aggression with other family members, but with time and patience. And she started to trust humans, and her aggression was purely nervousness, and she's just one big baby now.
Oh,
but she's the light of our lives, and we've become so passionate about rescue dogs. And we were living opposite Battersea Park, and we'd meet lots of people with rescue dogs like ourselves, and they all had unique stories to tell. So we thought, well, that would make a fantastic book. But we don't normally publish books on dogs or pets, and we only normally publish art books. So this is a new direction for us, but we've thoroughly enjoyed putting it together, and we're getting a lot of interest in the books, and we're going to continue with another book in the same series.
Smashing, that sounds great. Can you give us an idea of what's in the book? Can you tell us one or two of the stories from the dogs who've found their rescuers, please?
Yes, of course. I've got a nice couple of stories. The first one is a story about Leroy, who was saved after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. I don't think anybody will ever forget the nightmare of Hurricane Katrina. The aftermath of the September 2005 flooding left thousands of animals homeless. When Julie Goff heard that Operation Kindness, a no-kill shelter in Texas, was about to receive animals from New Orleans, she signed up to be the foster mum. Within a week, Julie received a call from the foster coordinator to say there was a Chihuahua Terrier mix scheduled to be euthanized. He had been a stray in New Orleans, and all the shelters within the vicinity were overwhelmed trying to reconnect animals with their families. This poor little boy was about to be overlooked because he was not in good health and no one had claimed him. Leroy, as Operation Kindness had named him, was about 2 and heartworm positive. He also needed to gain some weight. Julie's job as foster mum was to get him healthy and put him up for adoption. Wrapped in a blanket, Julie introduced Leroy to her husband, who swears it was love at first sight. They settled him into the guest bedroom with soft blankets and his food. We spent time petting and talking to him, and then left him alone to get some much-needed sleep. they made the joint decision that Leroy would never see the inside of a shelter again. Leroy has become my husband's best friend and my darling little clown.
Oh, lovely.
And they kept him, yes, they kept him. They, you know, they were going to foster him, but they actually kept him. And there's a wonderful little picture of him with the husband, you know, tiny little dog with this big husband's arms. It's really lovely.
it's a very hard heart that can actually resist a dog, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
My second story is actually about Henry. Henry is a black and white Jack Russell Terrier who was dramatically saved by a fireman from his home when it caught fire. His owners escaped and left him in the building. Can you believe it?
No, that's awful.
That's dreadful. The fireman took him to the local police station, who then brought him to Battersea Dogs and Cats Home, where they nicknamed him Sooty. Henry had been badly injured in the fire and was rushed to the emergency vet. One of his front legs had been so badly broken that it had to be amputated.
Aww.
Henry recovered well from the operation and was sent to the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home in Old Windsor to recuperate, which is set in the royal countryside of Runnymede. Henry was taken for quiet walks to build up his strength and to find the confidence to walk on three legs. Without the bustle of hundreds of other dogs, he managed to physically readjust and to put his terrible ordeal behind him. In August 2006, Henry was adopted by Dave Nicholson and Marjorie Thorogood as a much-wanted pet for their daughter Gemma. When they first saw him lying down in his kennel, they knew immediately that he was the one. "Ooh," said the lady, "you mean the three-legged one?" When the lady brought him downstairs, the Thorogoods were amazed at how well he coped. They had had no idea when they saw him in the kennel that he was missing a limb. The family has grown up surrounded by dogs and cats, and when their German Shepherd died, there was a hole in the household that Henry was able to fill. Battersea was justifiably very particular about who adopts their animals. The lady had come round and inspected their house, and they had to raise the fence at the bottom of the garden and get a dog gate so that Henry would not go upstairs and eat Vera the cat's food. Because Dave is retired, he could spend the necessary time working with Henry. What I like about Henry is he's so good with kids, does not snap or take out his affliction on them. He has a growl sometimes when you try to get him off the bed. He's a pub regular. The Thorogoods live in bang in the middle of Windsor, and Henry particularly likes being petted by all the pretty girls that pass by on the way to the corner pub. In fact, Henry is often found in the pub.
Well, he's fallen on his 3 feet there, hasn't he? You know,
I think he has, and I think he's become a good excuse for the owner to have a few pints himself.
Yes, I think so.
The third and final story, which is my favourite, is about Buddy. And this is a lovely story, actually. Buddy, a Chesapeake Bay Retriever, was put to work during his residence at the Canine Connection Rescue and Adoption Facility in Snoqualmie. Canine Connections operate a pet therapy program designed to save dogs from being put down by using them in conjunction with the Eco Glen Children's Centre. Eco Glen is a juvenile correctional facility for adolescents aged 12 through to 20. Buddy was rescued by Canine Connections from his original owner, who for 3 years had kept him chained up and pushing food at him. He got no affection, no exercise, and was left to lie in his own filth.
Oh, that's awful, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? But Buddy was paired up with a new handler, a hardcore ex-gang member convicted of numerous crimes, including cruelty to animals. Antisocial and sceptical, he was not thrilled to be given an equally obnoxious, destructive and unattractive dog as his therapy partner. There's actually a picture of Buddy in the book, and he does look not unattractive, because no dog's unattractive, but he does look a bit of a thug.
Aww.
I mean, Buddy was just not cool. the counsellors decided that the two were so alike, they just might learn from each other, as both boy and dog needed social reconditioning. Buddy's handler was taught at Chesapeake Bay Retriever's character traits, how to control Buddy's diet, get him used to being bathed, and how to groom him until he lost all his matted hair and his coat took on a shine. Most important of all, after positive reinforcements by Joe, the head counsellor, his handler learnt how to recondition Buddy's negative traits. She told him, "This dog will be a more loyal friend than any of his homeboys would ever be, that this dog would worship the ground he walked on and offer nothing but sincere devotion."
Mm.
But all, you know, all his so-called gang members that he thought were friends, you know, wouldn't touch on the loyalty and, you know, the friendship that obviously Buddy would offer.
Yeah.
Buddy's handler began to see the loyalty and unconditional bond and friendship that Buddy could offer as Buddy waited patiently by his kennel door, his tail pounding and his eyes fixed on his handler. The boy was amazed that anything could be so excited to see him, and they became inseparable. Joe was thrilled that this tough gang member showed his vulnerable side as he proudly boasted about his dog. He now talks about his crimes and shows compassion and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy has also reaped enormous benefits from the program. He dropped 15 pounds. His runny eyes and smelly ears are now healthy. And he lost about 3 bags of hair.
Good grief.
Actually, the picture, he looks all so matted and just, he's fair. I've never seen fair like it. Just looks so dull and lifeless.
Yeah.
And he knows how to love and how to accept love. He no longer has separation anxiety and is motivated by toys and not by aggression.
Mm.
But he has since been paroled to a new adoptive home, and his handler felt good that Buddy had been given a second chance. And this is a quote by the handler, you know, the young boy who was in the correctional facility.
Mm.
"When I was first assigned to Buddy, I judged him on his looks, not what was inside. I can see that I've done this all my life. If someone outside my gang was wearing other colours, I was fighting the colours, not the person. People are just like me inside. I learnt a lot from my dog."
Wow, that really is the power of a dog, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it changed his life. But I just thought that's a wonderful story because, you know, dogs just give unconditional love. There's no judgment there and, you know, just...
Yeah.
Getting back to the principles of life and what, you know, what really is important in our world. And that just about sums it all up, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It sounds a lovely book. I'm sure dog lovers everywhere are going to be interested in this. Where can they find out how to buy the book?
Yes. Your Dogcast listeners can buy the book from Amazon, amazon.com or amazon.co.uk or all major bookstores. They can also buy it directly from our website. That's our publishing website, which is angelapatchellbooks.com. If they buy it directly from the website, they can get a 20% discount.
Great, okay. We'll pop a link on the Dogcast Radio site to that.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned that you've been so inspired by the stories in this book that you want to sort of go on and publish more. And you'd like people to contribute, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. I would love for all those listeners out there, and I'm sure there's lots of them, that have their own rescue stories, that have rescued a dog, and have their own unique stories to tell. We would absolutely love to have them, because we're publishing a second edition of the book because of the huge interest and the huge success of it. So we are actually asking for people to send in stories.
Yeah.
If if with the stories you've got any pictures of your dog, I mean, preferably when you first had the dog and then after, when the dog is happy, and sort of, you know, as they were and as they are now, that would be wonderful. But if you don't have any pictures, don't worry.
Yeah.
You know, it's more important the stories is good.
Yeah.
If you could either email me the story on Angie, A-N-G-I-E, at angelapatchell.com, or you can go onto the website and you can, on the contact text page, you'll see that all my contact details are there. Or otherwise, you can ring me on 01424 830 311. If you want to talk to your story or unsure how to present it, just give me a ring and I'll be happy to talk to you about it.
Angela had a lovely quote about rescue dogs, and I wondered how she discovered it.
We were actually looking for a foreword for the book, and we were thinking, what should we do for the foreword? Because all the people that contributed to the first book, you couldn't choose between them. They were all champions of the dog world. But this one lady who set up the Victorian Canine Rescue Centre in Australia, her name's Von Barber, sent us a letter with a quote, and I just thought this quote just says it all, and I'll read the quote for you.
Yes, please.
If I was given the option of $1 million or a damaged, unwanted dog, which would I take? The answer is simple. Although not understood by most, I would take the damaged, unwanted dog to be given the gift of working with this dog, to have a dog so damaged that it has given up the will to live and all trust in humans, to have their spirit so damaged that everyone else thinks they are beyond help, to see the dog want to be touched and not to cower down, to treat the dog with kindness and respect, not like a piece of trash that can just be disposed of when they're no longer wanted. The first glimmer of trust in the dog's eye, the first wag of its tail and nudge of its nose under your hand, the first time you feel that they trust in what you're doing to help them, no amount of money can buy. I believe I do make a difference to that one dog that I've just worked with, the dog that no one else could be bothered with. I gave it a chance to have a new life, and in return it gave me the memory of that first tail wag, the first loving, trusting look, and the drive to save another one. That is why I rescue dogs. I thought it was just so wonderful.
Yes, yeah, that is beautiful.
Yes, because everybody that's rescued a dog, it's seeing, you know, seeing the trust come back. I know with Cleo, it took a long, long time, far longer than I'd imagined, before she actually began to even trust us. And even now we have to be sometimes a bit careful. She'd obviously been very badly treated. But, you know, just to see the change in them is just worth so much more than money.
If you would like to read more of the inspiring stories in Caring for Your Rescue Dog by Louisa Adams, or you have your own rescue dog story to contribute, follow the links on the Dogcast Radio site. A dog has the soul of a philosopher. Plato. If you've ever wondered which breed you would be if you were a dog, then the book, What Dog Are You, will be of interest. Here, you can take quizzes to find out which breed best shares your appearance, personality and life choices. To find out more, visit www.iamawhat.com. We heard in the news about the apparent dangers of letting dogs into our bedrooms, so I thought I'd share with you some of my own experiences of having not just one, but two dogs in the bedroom, and also the consequences. One of the most troublesome issues for me of having two dogs in the bedroom is noise. Before they fall asleep, we have padding around, scratching, and possibly growly squabbling as they vie for the best sleeping position. If so much as a leaf falls in the garden, they may both go into defensive barking mode. But once they fall asleep, they're quiet, right? Wrong. Sleeping dogs have a varied repertoire of sound effects, which range from snoring, to whining, to growling, and half-hearted barking. Dream-induced feet twitches can smack claws repeatedly onto laminate flooring. All of these can result in human occupants being woken. But the good news is that the noisy dog will continue sleeping undisturbed. A variant on the aforementioned noises is sneezing. Our Bichon has this down to a fine art. She can wake and produce a volley of sneezes that not only jolt me awake, but have me sitting up to peer over the edge of the bed to check if she is okay. As suddenly as the sneeze attack comes, it goes, and almost immediately she flops back down to sleep. The consequence for me is that I take longer to return to blissful slumber, before which one of them has invariably started up with some other noise. Duvet rolling is a canine sport that our dogs excel at. This occurs when during the night the duvet slips down the bed, allowing a good portion of it to rest on the floor. This apparently resembles a luxury dog bed, which both our dogs make the most of. They throw themselves onto it, dropping onto their backs and writhing in delight. The more energetic the rolling around becomes, the more duvet is pulled from the bed. In this scenario, we are not only eventually woken, but we wake up distinctly chilled, and to add insult to injury, we then have to wrestle the duvet back from the dogs. Then there is the dreaded nose push. This is where a juicy, wet canine nose is pushed beneath your bedclothes. A serious development of the nose push is when the cold, wet nose comes into contact with warm, dry human flesh. The consequence of this is that the human is brought to full wakefulness immediately. Strong language may be emitted, and the dog may well find himself excluded from the bedroom for at least the rest of the night. Having dogs in the bedroom does mean I have to wash the bedclothes more often, even though the dogs have their own beds. It happens like this. I finally give up on sleeping, thanks to the noise, the lack of duvet, and the poking of wet noses, and decide to get up. I let the dogs out into the garden, and then I sneak back to bed for a quiet 5 minutes, coming round. However, long before I have come round and am ready to face the day, the dogs return from their first foray into the garden. I hear them trot through the house, and not finding me elsewhere, they finally trot into the bedroom. Their delight at locating me causes them to momentarily forget their manners. Big Labrador forepaws and little Bichon forepaws are duly deposited on the bedside in the melee that ensues. Every day they seem surprised that even though their back paws are on the ground, they are still in violation of the bedroom rules and are made to get down. And every day it's too late, as the muddy paw prints have been made on the bedsheets. As you can see, there are many dangers in having dogs in the bedroom, and I haven't even mentioned the smells that can waft around, or the fact that nighttime bathroom visits are no longer a solitary event. However, and I know I'm not alone in this, I wouldn't have it any other way. Sweet dreams. Until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
A little boy was putting faces at a bulldog. When his mother asked him, "Why are you making faces at that bulldog?" the boy replied, "He started it."